Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for tuning in. Henrik here with Red Ice. Today we have a good show for you. We have Mark Collette back on the program. We're going to talk about some of the current events, some of the current news. Always a pleasure having Mark with us. Thank you for coming on again.
Thank you for inviting me. It's always a pleasure working with both you and Lana.
Thank you, Mark. Excellent. We have a number of topics lined up today, and I actually wanted to begin talking a bit about the shitstorm around Trump, daring to say that he's a nationalist. Let's actually just watch the short clip here first.
It sort of became old-fashioned. It's called a nationalist. And I say, really, we're not supposed to use that word. You know what I am? I'm a nationalist, okay? I'm a nationalist. Nationalist. Nothing. Use that word.
And then the crowd goes on to chant, USA, USA. And of course, it was a shitstorm. Sorry for the bad language, folks. But on Twitter, around this, in terms of the fact that Trump dared to say that he is a nationalist. And I was curious about the reaction, Mark, because why wouldn't a president of the United States of America be a national? What is he supposed to be? Is he supposed to be a globalist? Is he supposed to be an internationalist? And they equate this immediately, of course, with not only, racism and white nationalism and all these kinds of things. This is full on fascism now because he's a nationalist. Isn't that amazing, the reactions to this?
Well, I was very, very happy when I saw this because I think Trump has been the gift that just keeps on giving for us. I mean, he legitimized talking about mass immigration. People used to be quite scared talking about race, ethnicity, immigration. But when you have Donald Trump, a man who is a major, major media celebrity on a level you can't really imagine. I mean, in Europe, people aren't as aware of this, but in America, they certainly are. This guy is, you know, super famous. He's at the highest level of being looked up to as well, because he's the man that in many ways personifies the American dream. When you have a man like that legitimizing being critical of mass immigration, being critical of multiculturalism, that is one thing. But for him to come out and call himself a nationalist, well, that legitimizes everything we are. Because the globalists, the internationalists, the liberal politicians, the entire establishment have done everything they can in order to make it so that word is a dirty word, so it's taboo. So if you go out and identify as a nationalist, you are naturally silenced by people around you, you know, and they've obviously tried to tie the word nationalist to lots of negative connotations. So to have the President of the United States coming out and saying that he's a nationalist, this is just another absolutely fantastic bonus for us. And I think that's why the left are so bothered by this. This is why they're so enraged, because it's taken them absolutely decades to make discussion about immigration and multiculturalism taboo. It's taken them decades to turn words like nationalist and patriot into dirty words. And Donald Trump has more or less undone all of that mental conditioning. He's just undone in a matter of months. And that's why they're absolutely fuming. And when you sent me the show notes beforehand, I was looking through his Twitter, and I don't know if you can bring this up or if the particular tweet has been bumped down, but where he proclaims that he is a nationalist, or the tweet, there is a tweet commenting on him being a nationalist, the outrage in the string of tweets underneath is just absolutely beautiful. And sometimes I'm not sure what pleases me more, being legitimized in such a wonderful way on such a global scale by the man who is widely accepted to be the most powerful man in the world, or the literal sea of leftist tears when things like this happen. So for us, this is just another great day.
Yeah, it truly is, Mark. It's amazing that such sensible, just normal positions, I mean, 20 years ago has been, seems so radical today, right? That they've shifted the window so much to the left. And I think that they also have to continue with this pressure on people who are not even like, on the fringes of the right or far right, but even like center and moderate people, right? That somehow you not taking a position with them full on is equated now with extreme right views and stuff like that. And I think that they, in the media in the cultural narrative, and the politicians on the left, they have to continue to push that window towards the left to make it seem that these positions are unnatural. But again, my question to them would be, what is he supposed to be? Do they want an imperialistic president that gets in the business of all these other countries? You know, he's not the president of a global governance system. He's not the head of the UN. He's the head of America. He's supposed to look after the people that voted, not only voted for him, the people who didn't vote for him, but who are under him as their president, right?
Of course. I mean, it's absolutely absurd for anyone to look at their leader and want their leader to have greater interest in other countries, in other people, in other ethnicities, in other religions than they do their own. And at one time, had a leader been more interested in the well-being of other people, that leader would have been seen as a traitor and would have probably ended up meeting a sticky end at the end of a noose. Whereas now, that is seen as something that's virtuous. It's seen as something that's good. I mean, the media constantly hold up people like Angela Merkel as heroes, as people who are essentially beacons of tolerance and hope and decency, when really all she has done is allowed a swarm of people into her country who have been like a plague upon the indigenous people. They have attacked them, they have raped them, they have sexually assaulted them, they have abused their welfare and benefit system. The German people have gained nothing from this flood of migrants, and their leader is openly endorsing this to the detriment of the indigenous people. And that is held up by the media, as I said, as a virtue. Whereas Trump saying he wants to put America first, he wants to put the American people first, and he is a nationalist and loves his country. That, we are being conditioned to think, is something that should be seen as dirty or tyrannical. And it's very telling seeing the way these people are absolutely having mental breakdowns on Twitter, because on the Fox News report of this, on the Fox News tweet that you sent me earlier, the most retweeted item underneath it is some woman who's posting graphics about the Holocaust, saying that, you know, Trump coming out and saying that he's a nationalist.
Yeah, that's the one,
yeah. You know, this is literally the gift that keeps on giving.
You know,
when she studied the Holocaust, she thought, how did Hitler get over 6 million people to follow along blindly and not fight back? You know, how indeed? You know, maybe you should try questioning the official narrative there, love. But anyway, then she realizes Americans are following the same path. No, the Americans are finally waking up. But I don't think, well, really, I'm not sure whether people are waking up or whether people were always awake and they just needed that credible leader to follow. But either way, Trump's probably waking people up, and people who have already awoken but were too scared to act now feel they have the backbone and they feel they have the heart to follow him. Mm. And all of this is being absolutely fantastic for our cause. And I think it's legitimized nationalism, not just in America, but all over Western Europe. And I think that's given people the strength to vote for candidates like Marine Le Pen in France, vote for candidates or parties as they have in Sweden, where we've seen a swing right. And I think all of this is very, very positive for us. And I think the left do truly feel like they're losing their grasp on the entire political narrative. And that can be seen from their, you know, quite public mental breakdowns every time something doesn't go their way.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that this need also to immediately associate Trump's form of nationalism with an extremer form, or a nationalism more to the right, is also interesting to watch, because the lessons that we've learned from the NPC meme is, of course, that they are very, they don't like, leftists don't like to be dehumanized, right? That this was one of the big critiques of the NPC meme. Like, they're turning us into these robots and, you know, like just scripted characters where they're trying to make us seem not human. But wait a minute, everything that the left has been doing the last, for a long time now, but it really ramped up since the Trump presidency, is of course that they call everyone who doesn't hold their positions a neo-Nazi, a racist, a fascist, a, you know, et cetera, white nationalist, whatever it is. And that's done effectively to dehumanize it so that our arguments don't seem legitimate, right? That they're the experts on dehumanization. When we project that back, do some jujitsu right back at them, they literally cannot take that. And they're totally blind. And that's what you said, why it's so important that they bring up, like, the somehow just Trump saying he's a nationalist immediately means it will be another Holocaust, which is, of course, it's wrong. This is not the case. But they have to take that extreme position, Mark, so that it delegitimizes what Trump is doing and how he's normalizing nationalism, right?
One thing I was going to say to your comments about them calling us neo-Nazis or Nazis or far-right, I think that at one time those sort of names did hold quite a bit of power because they weren't used as much. When used sparingly, when used against certain opponents, those phrases had quite a bit of power, but they've been used too often. Think of them a little bit like antibiotics. If you use antibiotics too many times, whatever you're using them against builds up an immunity. And I think people have built up an immunity against phrases like Nazi, racist, and that has actually helped us an awful lot. Because when they called the BNP Nazis, people kind of bought that. And people were like, yeah, well, maybe they are. You know, they want repatriation. They want to stop immigration. But now they are calling everyone who is really right of center a Nazi. So everyone's a Nazi. Donald Trump's a Nazi. Nigel Farage is a Nazi. They call me a Nazi. They'll call you a Nazi. But they're calling everyone a Nazi. So that word no longer has any meaning. It no longer has any power. It is just a word again. Whereas before it was a word that carried quite a bit of weight. It was a word that when printed on a leaflet, when directed at BNP candidates, would put people off voting for us. But now they used it so liberally and they've overused it. It's watered it down. It's now meaningless. It now has no effect. It's like an overused antibiotic that simply doesn't hit the mark anymore. It simply doesn't have any effect. The immunity in people has been built up against this, and that's it. They're done. And calling Trump a Nazi is a major, major error from their part, because if they're saying the President of the United States is a de facto Nazi, that gives Nazis an awful lot of credibility. That says to people, well, actually, these guys, you know, they're back. They're doing something. You know, these guys, they can't be that bad because America elected one. And these words now have absolutely no meaning, and they've really depleted their own arsenal completely. And they've left themselves in a position where their once most powerful tools are now completely useless, meaningless, and the public just isn't listening to them at all anymore. So when they get memes like the MPC meme used against them, it hurts so much more. It stings so much more because their generalizations, their dehumanizing tactics aren't working, but ours are. And the funny thing about it is, ours are far more humorous, ours are far more witty, and that's what makes it even better, because the left obviously don't like losing. The left don't like seeing us winning, but they really, really hate being laughed at, because they have a very, very childish, silly mentality. And when you laugh at a silly child, the child throws a tantrum. And these leftists, these liberals, they really are grown children. And they're showing that now more than ever, because they're banning people for simply posting grey cartoons with stoic faces. And that shows, if anything, we are winning the culture battle.
Yeah, indeed. I thought we should take a look at the report as well from Fox, because a lot of this was triggered, Mark. Well, we don't have to look at the whole thing, but I want to play some B-roll here of the caravan that's coming in too, swelling to 7,000. Again, this is not one of the scenarios that triggered, of course, Trump's reaction of the fact that he's a nationalist. We can't just have wide open borders. Who are we if we can't, you know, protect ourselves and stuff like that? And it's interesting that, of course, we saw scenes like this, Mark, in Europe back in 2015, was it, that really kicked off, 1670. It's really continued since then. To a certain extent, the media has downplayed it since, but now we have it through boats and stuff like that, too. They don't only come by land. But what's the comparison here, do you see, in terms of the European migrant wave?
I think the biggest comparison you would see, this sort of so-called caravan, and between what's happening in Europe, is obviously the floods of these migrants that have been arriving at ports in Italy, Spain, southern France and Greece. I think what makes this particular movement of refugees, well, they're not refugees, are they? I mean, these people are clearly economic migrants. And one thing I'll have to say is, I find it hilarious that they claim to be fleeing Honduras, but at the front of this march, which looks more like a military movement, they're carrying the Honduran flag, like an invading army would. They aren't. They're carrying this flag as if there's a standard bearer at the front of the march saying, we're coming to take over your land in the name of Honduras. Now, if you're fleeing from a country, if a country's been brutally oppressing you, you wouldn't imagine the people who were fleeing would be carrying the flag of the nation or the regime that had been oppressing them. And that's a real giveaway. But I think this hits home a lot more, really, because it almost looks like a wave of zombies. It looks like a scene out of The Walking Dead, where you see thousands and thousands of shambling, you know, brain-dead creatures surging towards, you know, the last place of decency where the last survivors are holding out. And that's really what this looks like, and it's really what this is. You know, America is a place that's given the world so many innovations, so many wonderful inventions. It's been a bastion of freedom. It's been a bastion of integrity. And these people are trying to get there. And when they get there, they're going to ruin the quality of life for everyone. And something you will notice about this so-called caravan, I see there's a young child there that the news have sort of...
They always hone in on that. The one time they do get that shot, right? You know, same in Europe in the migrant invasion. Largely all males, all younger males. Yeah.
Exactly, all males carrying their battle flag, the flag of their nation that's meant to have been oppressing them, marching relentlessly like zombies towards the West. And it is frightening. And the fact that Donald Trump is standing up to this, the fact he has said he is going to dispatch the military to the border to turn these people back, that is an absolute breath of fresh air, because that is what we need. And the people who are supporting this mass of economic migrants and criminals flooding towards America, they have their hands. And I think many of the American people will see those supporting this caravan as absolute traitors. And yet again, having Donald Trump being a voice for patriotism, being a voice for nationalism, and voicing his absolute opposition to this is another massive bonus for our movement.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's amazing how, you know, they're trying to make it seem that there's no legitimacy in a country wanting to defend itself and wanting to defend its own borders. And why is it, Mark, that laws then only applies in certain circumstances, right? They want to have restrictions on politicians or whatever it might be, like, which I obviously agree with, like, you know, campaign finances. I'm talking about, like, largely what the left is talking about in terms of rules and laws and what we need, and there needs to be laws against hate speech and, you know, all these kinds of things, right? But all of a sudden, when it comes to migration, there should be no laws whatsoever. It should just be total open borders, let everyone in. And of course, you know, people who are what should we call it? People who are sentimental when it comes to helping people, and I'm not against helping people either, but as is stated, America already gives Honduras massive amounts of money in aid. They get help from other parts of the world, and I think the easier solution, instead of them making this dangerous march through all these countries and breaking borders, as we saw in Mexico, right? They were actually breaking through there. They were actually not respecting the country that they show up at. And I think even internationally, you're supposed to stop at the first country where there is peace, you know, from as a refugee. If you all want to seek asylum, go to the first country where there's peaceful conditions, and then you wait there and seek asylum there. But they're just marching straight through, just like they did in Europe too, right, to all these southern European countries, to go to Germany, to Sweden, to Denmark, Norway, Britain. And of course, so there's no rhyme or reason to how the following the rules when it comes to this stuff. And I've heard countless of people on the left defending this, that just like, well, they're seeking a better life and they're fleeing violence and horrendous conditions and stuff. Well, it looks like they're bringing these conditions right with them, and they don't respect the laws of the countries that they come to.
No, exactly. I mean, you've got the first thing you've got to look at when you discuss these sort of people is, if your house burned down and your neighbor took you in, Your neighbor gave you food, gave you water, gave you a bed, gave you a roof over your head. How would you repay that neighbor for doing that for you, for showing you that kindness? Well, if you were a genuine refugee, if you were somebody who was genuinely in need, if your house had really burned down, if you'd really lost everything, you would repay your neighbor with acts of kindness because of the kindness that he or she and their family had shown you and your family. But these people do not repay us with any kindness. When they come to our countries, when they come to America, when they come to European countries, they treat us with absolute contempt. They attack young men, they attack the elderly, they rape, they sexually assault young white girls. We've seen the absolutely huge grooming scandals here in Britain. We've seen scandals in Germany, like the scandal in Cologne on New Year's Eve, where thousands of women were molested and sexually assaulted in one evening. You see these horrendous terrorist attacks. And these people, when they come here, they claim to be fleeing regimes that are extremist. They claim to be fleeing groups like ISIS, fleeing extremist Islam. And they say they want tolerance. They want the West. And then as soon as they get here, what do? Well, we've seen in France where there was the Bataclan massacre. We've seen in France where an elderly priest was beheaded in his own church by two young migrant males. These people bring the problems from their own country into our nations, and they show us absolutely no gratitude whatsoever. And when you see the number of men of fighting age that you can see in these pictures now, you can actually see what this is going to bring to America. All of these young men are going to be looking for partners. All of these young men are going to be looking for, at best, they'll be looking for low-paid jobs, which pushes down wages, which means our people, the indigenous people in Europe, or the people who, the descendants of those who built the America we know and love, won't be able to get jobs. And at very worst, these people will be criminal elements who will join gangs, who will be smuggling drugs, who will be involved in other forms of criminality. And these people will make life, in one way or another, worse for the people in America, just as migrants have made life worse for people in Europe.
What do you think that people pointed this out, and let's just briefly talk about that. There's right to the, on the right side there on the screen, on the truck, there's the Star of David. I don't know if these pictures, this actually, it says right there, it's shot in Guatemala, right? And it was interesting because I think my angle was Israel. They're actually on location that is Honduras. I got to look up if it was Guatemala. Regardless, I guess technically that, you know, if you're in one country, you could help, especially if you have a truck and you're driving people across the borders or whatever this is a case of. But what do you think that's about? Is that a coincidence, Mark? Why is there a Star of David on the truck that's transporting people?
Well, it's very interesting. Now, I did a whole video on this called The Jewish Role in the Refugee Crisis, and that was quickly shuffled off to the YouTube bin of limited state, so you can't actually search it.
Down the memory hole, down the memory hole. Quarantining, exactly, it's amazing.
It's also up on Minds.com, though, and BitChute, so it can still be accessed.
Yeah.
But when I was looking into the Jewish role in the refugee crisis, I came across the group called Israel, and I actually exposed this group because it's very, very interesting that the Jews in Israel don't want any refugees coming into Israel. In fact, repeatedly, Jewish prime ministers and high-ranking Jewish politicians in Israel have categorically stated that they will not be allowing in any refugees, and they are aggressively seeking to repatriate people who have entered Israel's borders illegally, or sometimes even legally, and have settled there, including a large number of Africans who they are shipping back to Africa. In Israel, there is a group called Israel, which are a pro-refugee charity. But before you say anything, they are not pro-refugee in Israel. They don't want to help refugees come to Israel. Oh no, this charity sends Israelis abroad to help refugees and migrants enter other Western nations. So they have been very active on the ground in places like Italy, in places like Greece, trying to help migrants enter Europe illegally and then dispersing them and resettling them across Europe so that they can't be deported. And I would not be shocked at all if they were on the ground working, helping to flood America to help migrants cross the southern borders and get in to America. And this group, Israel, really is the perfect illustration of the hypocrisy practiced by Israeli Jews who want a wall for Israel, who want closed borders, who want an ethno-state, which is for the Jewish people, and essentially a bolt hole for all Jewish people the world over if they need it. But the Israeli Jews from Israel are very, very eager to flood Western nations like Italy, Greece, France, Germany, where the European people are the indigenous people, but they're also very, very eager to flood other Western nations where the European people may not be indigenous, but their ancestors were the ones that founded those nations and made them what they are today. And they are very, very eager to push open borders, miscegenation, and mass migration in those nations. And this huge double standard is one of the best ways to illustrate the hypocrisy that is practiced by these people. And you only have to wonder, what is their end goal in doing these things?
Let's talk about some of the reactions to this then, because it makes sense that our questioning, I don't think it's only Israel and Israel that's behind this. I think there's many different organizations. Frankly, they play a large part, and we know that within their respective countries too, they lobby. And you have is it Haifa? It's called or HAIS, the Hebrew immigration organization. I can pull it up here in a moment. But there's clips there talking about how rabbis they're agreeing on making sure that America gets more immigrants and stuff like that. And they kind of they link it again with their own experience that supposedly. I even heard Cenk Uygur at the Young Turks bring this up the other day, that he was debating with the Tucker Carlson. And it was like, well, the reason why America needs to let in people is because the Holocaust, right? America didn't let Jews in the 30s and 40s, and therefore you don't have a right to control your own borders. Therefore, you don't even have a right to have a processing system where you figure out who is who. Remember all the complaints on the cages, just a few months ago? In terms of the fact that they were like, they have a processing facility, this is the best they have, it's not a prison, it's just it's walls, but instead of having actual walls, they have fences, right? And so they need to process and figure out who is coming in. Is it terrorists? Is it ISIS? Is it who is it, right? And so that's sensible and reasonable, but they're trying to make it seem that it's like, just do away with all that, open your borders. And so the reaction has been hysterical to this, Mark. I mean, surely they must also at some level recognize that the lives of their own people is worth, isn't even worth equally to the people coming in. And if there is a chance that there's terrorists coming into the country or drug dealers or gang members or something like that, that should be able to be, they should be able to filter, if you will, for that.
Well, yeah, it's a very good point that it's not all Jews. Not all Jews are involved in this. And it's also a good point that not only Jews are involved in this. There are other groups. Now, when you look at Africans, when you look at those from the Middle East or Latin Americans who are aiding this, it's very understandable from their point of view. They obviously want more of their friends, more of their family, more of their community to come and join them here in the West. But that underlines another very, very important issue, that none of this is about integration. They are not coming here to integrate. They're not coming here to become Western or to become European. They are coming here to import their own culture, to import their own mini version of their homeland or their home nation, but to do so with all the benefits of living in the West, the free healthcare, the free housing, the free medical care. They are coming here to essentially reap the economic benefits whilst bringing their own cultures, traditions, way of life and entire community, which really shows what's going to happen to the West. Now, there is a third group who are involved in this, of course, and that is other white people. Now, we have a problem as people of European descent in that we're suffering from something known as pathological altruism, where we are actually putting the well-being of other groups before the well-being of ourselves. And if you think of it in a certain way, think of a lion. If the lion was more worried about the well-being of the gazelle, he would go hungry and starve and eventually die. Equally, if the gazelle was more worried about the well-being of the lion than he was about himself and his fellow gazelles, he would soon be eaten and he would have virtually zero life expectancy. You have to look after your own group first. Sometimes that will be to the detriment of others. You know, sometimes that will mean putting your own group above other groups. And we have to close our borders. We have to look after our own people. And yes, that will mean that other groups, other ethnicities won't be able to come to the West, won't be able to take advantage of our economies, of our healthcare, of our educational systems. But so be it. We have to put our own people first. And it isn't like we're living in utopia. It isn't like we have a nation or a group of nations that don't have problems of their own. And it's only natural to put your own people first. After all, charity begins at home. And something that we have to come up against, something that we have to conquer, isn't just the problem of globalist power. It's not just the problem of groups like Israel Aid or the Jewish lobby. It's a problem of our own people who have effectively been brainwashed by the liberal establishment and the media into hating themselves to the point where they feel they should put other predatory groups above themselves and essentially speed their own racial demise. And you have white people now fighting for what is white genocide.
Yeah, exactly. It's true. I mean, it's absolutely amazing. And, you know, we had people speaking out, of course, like Paul Krugman. I want to talk about this just really quick before we switch over and actually talk about Faith Goldie and her campaign. I know you have a lot of opinions about this and some strong opinions, and it would be good to actually discuss that and see what has happened with her campaign and how that all came out. You know, there's a lot of interesting twists and turns in that, shall we say. But here's one from Paul Krugman, and this is the guy who famously, of course, he was, I think, was heading up the Federal Reserve for a time. He's a Nobel-winning economist, but anyway, he said, Trump lies about Soros funding the caravan. It might not be Soros directly. Maybe there is proof of that. I haven't looked directly if there is this, you know, some organization that's tied to him that is involved. I wouldn't be surprised if it isn't. But he says it's a further mainstreaming of an alt-right conspiracy theory. Jewish financiers are scheming to replace you with brown people. And he goes on and talks about all these, you know, Steve King is bad and blah, blah, blah. But it's interesting, of course, that, you know, you can't talk about demographic alteration, you know, Mark, in terms of like, well, I mean, either it's happening or it's not, and either we have proof for it or we don't. And, you know, from the I always forget the abbreviation of it. It's not Haifa. I'm thinking of the town, the city in Israel, the town in Israel. But it's Haida. I'll pull it up here in a moment. But it's a Hebrew organization that started directly to propagate immigration in different countries, and specifically America. Then you have the Barbara Spectors. You have, you know, a lot of people that come from the intellectual, you know, kind of university environment. Who are Jewish, who are advocating for open borders and stuff like that. So it is kind of a provable fact. But it's funny that the guy, this is what I think is funny about the article there that he links to, Paul Krugman, and I think he's written himself on the New York Times, is that he blamed, if we look at war as a driver aspect of immigration, he deflected, I remember in a piece back in 2015, Paul Krugman, called Error and Lies, where he talked about how basically he deflected from the neocons, the neoconservatives, and basically just singled out all the Gentiles, if you will, in the neocon movement, if we can call it that, and blamed them as opposed to his own peers that were advocating for the Iraq war at the time. And, of course, the Middle Eastern wars, Mark, has been the primary driver of immigration into Europe in the last, you know, 10, 20 years. So it's funny that this guy makes a statement about this, doesn't back it up, just deflects and say this is a crazy conspiracy theory. And then he blames other people for things that, you know, he and his ilk in the neoconservative branch did themselves.
No, indeed. And anyone that doesn't think that some of these Zionist groups are conspiring against us Do watch my video on the Jewish role in the refugee crisis. You will see here in Britain that every major Jewish group, right up to the British Board of Deputies, who are the most powerful and well-established Jewish group in the UK, fully support mass migration into Europe and into the UK. And he is calling this a conspiracy theory, but it isn't. There is a wealth, an absolute wealth of evidence pointing towards powerful Jewish groups and, of course, the media themselves, which is pushing for the acceptance of these people. And if you look at who owns the media, if you look at the people who are creating the news, who are pushing these narratives upon us, those people are overwhelmingly Jewish. Now, not every one of them is a Jew, but Jews are disproportionately involved in this form of anti-Western activity. And by calling this a conspiracy theory, well, that's just an utter nonsense. There's no conspiracy at all in the sense that he's talking about. The conspiracy is an active and real conspiracy that is aimed at destroying Western civilization and bringing about white genocide. And the interesting thing about this is you will actually be able to Google pictures of Jews holding up placards saying, "Jews will replace you. We will replace you." That is what these people are saying. And they are being very, very open and very, very honest about their desire to do this and the fact that they are involved in doing this. And you only have to go onto Twitter to see a huge number of Jewish individuals with blue check marks by their name who are on a daily basis calling for white genocide and attacking people for simply being white. You can see that this is prevalent, this is disproportionately represented within their community, and that is very real, it is very present. And it is a driving force behind the problems that we've been speaking about tonight.
Yeah, exactly. And there is a couple of other articles quick here, and then we'll move on to Faith, and also underlines that there's other people behind it, of course. One of the organizers, who's a left-wing-leaning lawmaker, was actually arrested in Guatemala. His name was Bartolo Fuentes. Guatemalan police officers detained Bartolo Fuentes, a former Honduran lawmaker from the middle of the large crowd. Then he and three other organizers had led from San Pedro Sula, Honduras, since Saturday. And the article says the organizer of a migrant caravan from Honduras was detained. So that's good. And, of course, Trump threatened as well on top of that with, we will cut off funding if you guys do this. I'm just questioning if that had anything to do with it at this point, that they figured, well, if America's going to cut this off, maybe this is not, cut off our aid or our funding, maybe that's not a good thing. Let's arrest the guy. Let's just break it up. Last time it broke up, I think, at the U.S.-Mexico border. But what do you think is going to happen this time? Is it going to get through? Is there enough media attention to it? This is the guy, by the way. This is the Bartolo organizer on the Honduras end.
I'm not sure. I think if Trump is true to his word, and mainly when Trump isn't true to his word, it's because people within the establishment, people within the deep state are stopping him. They are obstructing what he wants. He will deploy the military. He will deploy a heavy number of ICE agents. He will deploy all the forces he can to stop these people. And I do believe he is actively against this type of mass immigration. He might not be all the way there with the things that we believe. He might not be 100% on board with some of our deeper ideals, but he is 100% on board in stopping immigration. And over his time as president, we have seen him drift further in our direction, which has been evidenced just the other day by the fact he has now stated quite proudly that he is a nationalist and there is nothing wrong with being a nationalist. So, yes, I believe he will do his best to stop them entering the U.S.
So, Mark, let's switch over. There's a lot of more to say, of course, about the caravan, about people behind it and all that stuff. But, it's important to discuss these things that are in the news. Before we go on to some of the other topics and talk more in the second part of this show, let's talk a bit about Faith Goldie's campaign and how you view this, Mark. I know that you did another interview. I heard the snippet that you did on that. You were highly critical of the direction that the campaign had taken. Why don't you just frame this for us a little bit and describe what happened and how you view her campaign?
Well, firstly, it's very important to note that initially I was a massive supporter of Faith Goldie. I believe that standing for Mayor of Toronto was something that we should all endorse, we should have all have got behind her, we should all have helped in any way we can to ensure that she did as well as possible in that election. And I, in fact, did a show, my show this week on the alt-right on YouTube. You can go back and see that. We had Greg Johnson on that particular episode, and we spent a large part of the show praising her courage, and saying that this was exactly what nationalists need to do, that we need to get out there, we need to engage the public, we need to stand in elections, because we can't simply ghettoise ourselves on YouTube or on the internet. We can't simply spread memes on Twitter and expect to change the world. There are people who don't go on the sites we go on. There are people who aren't aware of these YouTube personalities who produce wonderful content every week. And we need to get to the wider public, to the average guy on the street, and we need to recruit aggressively. And one way to do that is by standing in elections, because it raises our profile and it allows us to use the establishment's apparatus in order to spread our message. So when Faith stood, I was really behind that. I've stood for election many times. I was involved in campaigns that actually won significant power here in the UK. Elected in 2008 to the Greater London Assembly. So I'm all for that. And I think what Faith did was admirable. However, she had spent a large period of time before that campaign cozying up to the alt-right. When she left the Rebel, she came to our side. She even came on my show. She was on This Week on the Alt-Right. She did a show around Christmas time last year with us. She was talking about internationalists and globalists, and she was making all the right noises, saying that she'd come to our side. She was an ethno-nationalist. She believed in the 14 words. And she was obviously doing this to gain money. People were donating to her. People were very, very eager to jump on board with her. I mean, after all, she's a very, very attractive woman. Many men will have looked at her and said, wow, you know, she's very, very beautiful, and she's espousing everything that we want to hear. So that, for her, will have been quite a significant payday. Now, when she entered this election, I wasn't suggesting she should have fought it on a 100% white nationalist ticket. Now, obviously, if you're fighting an election and people from ethnic minorities say, well, you're a white nationalist or you're a nationalist, what do you think about us? I'm not suggesting you're rude to them. I'm not suggesting you exclude them. But what I am saying is that as a nationalist, as somebody who is an ethno-nationalist, somebody who believes in, you know, an ethno-state, somebody who wants the survival of the European people in their homelands, you have to draw certain lines. And one of those lines is not to pander to ethnic minorities. When you stand in these elections, you can't be seen as the same as all the rest. You can't be seen as somebody who went and sought funding from the alt-right, cozied up to the alt-right, and then immediately did the opposite. And that's what she has done. She not only produced several very cringy posts where she was with Laura Loomer. Now, Laura Loomer is obviously Jewish. Laura Loomer was involved, well, was the one behind the doxing of Mike Enoch's mum. She's reprehensible. She is not a friend of ours. She constantly attacks us. Yet Faith Goldie could not wait to be pictured with her. She even produced a cringe-worthy post on Instagram where she said, "This will be huge. Jews for Faith." It was absolutely cringeworthy. But worse than that, she then was seen on the streets of Toronto with a group called the Jewish Defence League. The Jewish Defence League is like an ultra-violent version of Antifa. They physically attack white nationalists. They physically attack people who they deem to be anti-Semitic. They are actually listed by the FBI as a domestic terrorist group, and I believe they've even killed people who they believe are a threat to the Jewish community. Now, considering she was all over us when she needed a new home, she was all over us when she needed funding, when she needed people to look after her because she'd been sacked from the Rebel, and we were very, very welcoming of her. We rolled out the red carpet. We actively supported her. We helped fund her. For her to do this is, to me, It's absolutely treasonous. And to stand with people who would advocate physically attacking the likes of me and you and your viewers and my viewers is absolutely reprehensible, especially considering she turned to our viewers for financial backing. Now, I know what people have said about me saying this. They've said that I'm missing the point, that she had to do this to get elected. In fact, somebody said in one of the comment sections, they might have deleted it by now, it might still be there, that, you know, she's going to win this, and she couldn't win it without the support of all these people. Well, she didn't win it. She got 3.4%. Now, to go out there and literally grovel and bow to these Jewish groups, to these people who have doxxed nationalists like Mike Enoch, to people who advocate violence against people like myself, people like Dr. David Duke, people like you, and to only get 3.4%, was it really worth selling out for that small number of votes? Now, people will say, well, she got 3.4%, but Toronto is only 47.7% white European. Well, yes, but David Duke in Louisiana in 2016, he took 3%, and Louisiana is 52.4% white European. Very similar demographics, very similar percentage of the vote. Paul Neelan took 11.1%. And he didn't cut to anyone. I mean, Patrick Little took 1.35% in California, which is only 40.1% white European now. So Faith Goldie, for all of her bending over backwards, for all of her selling out, for all of her cozying up to our enemies. Now, bear in mind, she's not gone along to a black community center and said, you know what, guys, I'm going to represent you equally. I'm going to make sure you get a fair deal. You know, I want a fair deal for my people, but I will make sure you are represented also because you would be my constituents. She hasn't come out and said something reasonable or something acceptable like that. She has cozied up to people who would commit physical acts of violence or even kill people like us. And what did it gain her? What, 0.4% more than David Duke? Less than what Paul Neelan achieved? It's, you know, what gain has she actually got from this? Other than insulting people who were firmly in her corner and were willing to fund her when she was going through a very, very bad time in her life. Now, I know what her supporters will say about this, and this is very important. She's played out that she's the biggest victim ever. She wasn't allowed at hustings. Newspapers wouldn't run her adverts. Well, you know, newsflash here, people. This has been going on for years. When the BNP used to stand here in England or in the UK, we used to have it much worse than that. Newspapers wouldn't run our adverts. Billboard companies, they would sometimes put our billboards up, but take them down days later, you know, before the campaign had even concluded. After taking our money, nonetheless, they take our money, put the billboards up for a day when they were meant to be up for, you know, a week or 2 weeks, then pull them down saying they'd had pressure from the left or from establishment politicians. When our candidates were invited to hustings or debates, the other candidates would gang together and say, if you invite the BNP candidate, none of us will come. So it's either all of us debating each other or it's the BNP candidate stood alone. So the organisers would sheepishly come to us and say, look, this has happened. We can't invite you guys. So we weren't invited to hustings. But we had it even worse than that. We would often face situations where different established parties would back out of elections to ensure that we didn't win. So, say you had a ward where, you know, the Labour Party are on roughly 30% and the Liberal Democrats were on roughly 30% and the BNP could come in and get 35% and actually take that ward, the Lib Dems and Labour would form an electoral pact where one of those two parties would stand down to ensure that 60% of the vote went to the remaining party, so there was no chance of us winning. So these dirty electoral tactics are absolutely nothing new. Now, I know she got a lot of sympathy, she will have raised a lot of money for this, but don't be fooled into thinking, like, she's making out that this is the only time this has ever happened in the history of politics, and, you know, they went all out to stop her in Toronto. they've been going all out to stop us for decades. You know, when I used to stand as a candidate, groups would go round putting up posters and leafleting houses saying, don't vote for this Nazi, with a huge picture of me with a red arrow pointing at my head. You know, I had to put up with that time and time again. This is absolutely nothing new. It's been going on for decades. And in doing this and saying this and making herself out to be a victim, she may have raised quite a significant amount of money and got some sympathy. I'm not saying she was treated fairly, because she wasn't. But the fact of the matter is, she has turned her back on us, she has stabbed us in the back, and she has shown herself to be an opportunist. She was with the rebel, she was shilling for Israel on a huge level. She even made videos telling people in America to buy certain Israeli-made guns to help fund Israeli businesses, to help keep the state of Israel in a positive trade balance, or in a more positive trade balance, because there are certain groups that obviously boycott Israeli goods. Then, when everything went sour at the rebel, we welcomed her with open arms, despite the fact that she had been so pro-Israel, despite the fact she had been a massive Zionist. And when she'd taken our money, when she'd taken our shelter, when she'd been on all of our shows and obviously tried to recruit many people who watch shows like this, who watch shows like mine, who watch a range of different output across YouTube, she then turned tail, went to our enemies, went to people who regularly attack us, you know, both with words and with physical violence, and she thinks that's acceptable. Now, I don't think that's acceptable, and I hope your audience agrees with me in the fact that this isn't acceptable, and the fact that she is a beautiful woman should not be a get-out-of-jail-free card for her, but that is what she's going to play on. And if she does come crawling back, if she does attempt to come back on shows like this, then people should call her out, and people should say, what the hell did you think you were doing, cozying up to our enemies as soon as it seemed like it would be financially rewarding to do so?
Well, that's depressing, obviously, and, you know, in terms of, like, trying to, you know, turn, I guess, in terms of wherever the wind is blowing or where you can find support, eventually ends up biting you in the butt, because at some point you're going to be having, you know, contradictions and opposing forces and stuff like that. So, of course, it was a run-in with the JDL, as you said, the Jewish Defense League, that, or a run-in. It was a you know, a co-joint, I don't know if it was a press conference or if they did an event on the street. I didn't actually see that video. What was that specifically, Mark?
I don't know what it was, but she played up to this and made a huge thing of it. She was very, very eager to be seen with a number of Jewish groups or Jews before this event to point out that she was on their side. And the very, very interesting thing about this is, if you actually look at the demographics in Toronto, those people make up a very, very small percentage of the population. There are much bigger ethnic groups than Jews in Toronto, and she didn't seek their approval. She aggressively sought the approval of individuals and groups who have attacked us by either doxing us, by producing material that seeks to attack us with propaganda, or groups that seek to physically attack us, like the Jewish Defense League. And I find that absolutely reprehensible.
Yeah, it's very strange, very bizarre. You don't wonder if this is planned, or if she's just going wherever the flow, I guess, and support comes from at that time. I don't know. As you said, I mean, she was ousted from, the rebel and all the things after the Charlottesville kind of debacle, which I think was totally unfair, by the way. She was there as a journalist. I don't even know if she knew about the what the podcast was, whatever, but irrelevant, whatever. It's like she must have been able to have conversations with people. But of course, as you say, so she kind of shifted her shifted her focus on terms of who she's trying to reach a little bit, right? And of course, now when this Loomer kind of street circus there as well, that seems to be beneficial as well, to get kind of, I think after this, immediately she got on InfoWars too, which is like, she was, you know, she got the okay stamp from Alex Jones. You know, it's just interesting how it always goes that way. Cause for a while there, I bet you they thought she was like blacklisted, right? But, now she's back in with with that crowd again. We'll see how that goes. I don't think Ezra is going to let her back into the rebel though. What do you think?
I'm not sure. That's what she seems to want to do. And she's one of these people that she said, oh, I'm awoke to all of these things now. She came on my show. She was talking about internationalists. She was talking about the globalists. You know, off camera, she was joking with us all about these things and how she was awake to them. You know, but she wasn't. This was all just a game. All she appears to have done is chased whoever will pick up the tab after her. And for a while, we were the group of people who were going to provide her with the donations and with the funding she needed for the upkeep of her lifestyle. And her actions during this election have painted her as nothing more than an untrustworthy fraud. And for what? 0.4% more than David Duke? A significant percentage of the vote less than what Paul Neelan achieved? She certainly hasn't gone out there and done this and blazed a trail and made electoral waves. She was well off the pace of winning. And I know that she'll say she's saying now that she was on the podium, that she came third. Well, she got 3.4%. You know, she was so far off the other, off the two main candidates. She didn't stand a chance. You know, and I have been a part of an organization that has made major electoral inroads. The British National Party had 56 councillors, we had two MEPs, we had a seat on the GLA, which is the Greater London Assembly, and we did all of that without cucking. We did all of that with proper ethno-nationalist policies and a call for Britain, or the UK, to remain overwhelmingly white. And we certainly did not cozy up to any of these groups who have threatened violence or attacked white nationalists.
What do you think she should have done? Is there kind of a in-between thing? Or I mean, because from my point of view, sometimes you can just avoid things, just kind of stay away from certain things or not address it or not, you know, to take a clear stand. I mean, I understand the political, you know, kind of game and stuff like that in terms of, you know, appealing, but this is kind of such a weird overstep in terms of, you know, in this direction, especially if she had some, you know, prior feud with the JDL guy. And that was the lawyer too, right? Last name Ruben, I forget who the guy, but he had defended, I guess, Islamic terrorists in the past and even pedophiles, I believe, and I understand that if she's such an untouchable candidate, this might have been the only guy that she could get. But at the same time, I think all the legal fees, is funnily enough, then went to a guy which previously was involved in all these cases, which she herself criticized. Isn't that correct?
Well, that just shows that, to be honest, that's news to me now, but that just puts a big rubber stamp of on what I've just said. She really is someone who appears to be rather soulless, who has no real moral compass and has just used people on the alt-right. She has clearly taken us for a ride, but I don't know. She will obviously say that she had to do these things. She had to do these things for a wider appeal, but I don't see that. If you're standing as a candidate, there is nothing wrong with being cordial with people. There is nothing wrong with being polite with people. There is nothing wrong with, you know, retaining your dignity and having an air of decency about you. But going to your enemies and selling out, and more importantly, trying to appeal to those who would attack, those who have sheltered you, backed you, and given you finance, is frankly quite scandalous. And I think throughout this, she has painted herself as a mercenary who has a complete lack of moral compass.
We have a really shitty connection today on Skype for some reason, Mark. I don't know what it is. We can't seem to. We have to restart it a number of times or whatever. But thankfully, I can still hear you and see you, although the quality is a bit lessened. So sorry about that, folks, you guys out there watching. Mark, we're going to continue our conversation with a lot of important news we're going to get to in the second part of this interview as well. Give us an update in terms of how the book is going. Give us a plug for that. Tell us about your website, what people should do to follow you. You're still on Twitter. You have a YouTube channel. Just tell us about that before we wrap up here, the first part.
Yeah, you can download my book. It's a free ebook. It's called The Fall of Western Man. It's available from www.thefallofwesternman.com. You can also buy that in hardback and paperback. And if you want to see more of my content, you can hop over to my YouTube channel or follow me on Twitter or add me on Facebook.
Absolutely. Check it out, folks. The Fall of Western Man. Of course, it's available through the site. We'll link that up. We'll have a link to Mark's YouTube channel as well. It does a lot of good videos over there, so definitely check that out. All right, we're just going to take a short break. Thank you, Mark, for the first part. We will be right back. We'll see you on the other side. Part two with Mark Collette. Join us in the member section. We're going to be talking about the bomb threat at George Soros' New York City apartment. Really interesting story. We talk about whether or not it's a false flag or if there's actually some people that are trying to go after, and considering how much press he's been getting in the last couple of years regarding being behind a lot of meddling, if you will, in America's and also Europe's affairs. We speak about a Russian woman charged with midterm election meddling simply for posting basically a few memes online on Facebook is called conspiracy to commit information warfare. Very interesting. And of course, very Orwellian, very dangerous. This might be the thing that's being hauled out to actually effectively shut down dissenting voices. Just label it as election meddling and saying that it's you're knowingly spreading misinformation or disinformation. We also speak about some UK developments, including crybabies that want to have a revote on Brexit. Yes, believe it or not, they actually went out in the streets, demonstrated to get Britain to vote again, just like they did in Ireland on the EU referendum years and years ago. We speak about the sexual habits of young people that is now changing, according to a new study, due to access to pornography online. And we're also going to be talking about Britain's first official transgender student officer being suspended, basically due to being a pervert. I'm just trying to beat the YouTube algorithm here, folks, so don't worry if some of the words sound off. So join us in part two at redicemembers.com. Get a membership, support what we do, join our Telegram group as well, t.me/redicetv. Also, check out our new t-shirts that are incoming. We have a new batch incoming here soon. We have some new awesome designs, and we're restocking some of the old favorites too. redice.tv/store. All right, guys, we'll close out this segment on an oldie but a goodie. Digging a Grave with Faith No More. Enjoy. We'll talk to you on the other side of the break.